powered by Riverside FM.
Hi there. This is Rabbi Rachel Hirsch broadcasting from Jessa's Falls Grove office in Rockville, Maryland. And this is the first episode of our new Resiliency Radio podcast. We'll be focusing on all the different ways that we support resilience in our community for people of all backgrounds, all ages, all stages. Today, we are so excited to sit down with Jessa's Senior Director for Mental Health Services, Joe Wilson. And we're going to get to talk with Joe today about the topic of how we communicate most effectively with teens. So welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Rachel. Great to be here on the inaugural broadcast.
Yes.
I'm very excited.
Picked a good one for today. So before we get to our topic, I want to just get to know you a little bit, Joe. You have been at Jessa for
9 years.
9 years, almost a decade. And while you've been here, the mental health services division has grown by leaps and bounds.
Yes.
Reaching into areas of the community that the agency hasn't touched in the past. Before you came to Jessa, you had a lot of experience working with teens, children, families, as an independent clinician, and also as a leader in mental health. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me today. I'm very excited to be here. I began my career as an elementary educator. Mm-hmm. I worked for Montgomery County Public Schools and began as a second grade teacher. Mm-hmm. And then from there, taught middle school. And then at some point after getting my MSW, I left the school system, and I became full-time into social work.
Yeah.
I worked for a community mental health agency in the community for a number of years while I was getting my degree. And then following that, worked in private practice, worked for other community agencies. I was working with the wraparound program in Montgomery County back when we first got our first SAMHSA grant in 1998.
And just for people that may not know, explain what wraparound is.
Sure. It's not a clinical service per se. It is a process of facilitating youth and families to communicate with one another around strengths and needs and identify what's important to address and create a team for that to happen, for parents and kids to talk about what their needs are, and for the team then to figure out how they can connect to community resources and programs to support meeting those needs. Mm-hmm. And over time, we hope that we leave the family with better ways of talking about their strengths and needs and how they can connect to resources in the community without our assistance. And so they hopefully help families achieve a level of self-sufficiency, and they can manage their own needs to stay in their community. Mm-hmm. I was there with Maryland Choices, was the first provider that worked in the county to provide that, and so was there for a number of years. After that, I went to Walter Reed Army Medical Center, did some work there with young adults and adults, of course, in the military system. And then from there, went to Loudoun County, Virginia, and I was the director for the mental health and substance abuse services for the county there.
So you really have a very broad perspective.
I've seen it all, you could say.
Yeah, it really sounds like it. And you also bring to your work a really frontline perspective, and you're able to then bring all that knowledge and experience into directing a whole division of many clinicians and practitioners.
Yes, our team of 85 professionals and students. The experience has been really helpful in how we design service delivery and how mm-hmm. we really engage families, communities, individuals where they are. It's been really helpful over the years to sort of have a varied experience as to, you know, how we engage and find people where they are, so they can engage with services.
Yeah, and it's been exciting, I have to say, just from my perspective, to watch Jessa spread its wings even wider.
Not only do we do mental health services, as you might expect, traditional counseling, individual, family, group counseling, but we do sort of mental health adjacent services, such as care management. We actually do wraparound practice here now, and therapeutic mentoring. And so we've gotten ourselves into other services that can support access not only to needed supports in the community, but if they need mental health services, we can move them into mental health services. So we have a nice continuum of care.
It really sounds like an incredibly supportive and resiliency building set of offerings.
Absolutely.
Really wonderful to have you lay that out for us. Want to turn to focus on the specific topic of teen mental health. Jessa has been engaged in a special initiative for the last 2 years called the Resiliency Roundtable, which you've been part of, and others at the agency have been. And this is focused on the challenge of teen mental health. Certainly, the challenge of teen mental health is not limited to the Jewish community, but really something that's been an issue nationally across all identities, races, religions, even socioeconomic groups. First of all, what's your understanding or what's your perspective on what is going on with that data? Why are we seeing such a rise in stress and anxiety among teens?
You know, I think we've been seeing it for a number of years, and I would trace it back to what I think is probably the beginning of a dramatic rise in needed attention for teen mental health, which goes to school shootings. Mm. Not since, I mean, since Columbine happened and the years ensuing, there has been, despite what the national attention has been more on the perpetrators of the violence and sort of how to prevent.
Yeah.
But we've seen a dramatic shift into also recognizing the impact of that trauma, even the trauma of just living in a society where you can go to school and you have to be trained how to manage an active shooter drill.
Absolutely.
And so I would say, despite, again, the national attention that's been more focused on how to prevent it, which I think is somewhat of a fool's errand if we're not talking about gun control and we're not going to get political. But but when we think about teen mental health, the awareness of and the evidence around the impact of school climate mm-hmm. has been dramatic in the last 15 to 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been hugely responsible for bringing to light the fact that teens are experiencing greater levels of stress, more anxiety and depression, and certainly peeling back what we've always seen as some of the more mysterious layers of what it's like to be a teenager, right? Mm-hmm. Where I would say my generation, your generation, we probably talked about, you know, well, that's just normal teen behavior. You know, that's what it's like being a teen, raging hormones. And the truth is, it's much more than that. And we're seeing consequences of that untreated mm-hmm. more and more mm-hmm. as we see kids basically sort of progress through the school system and recognize that if we don't address those key components of stress, anxiety, depression, isolation, mm-hmm. Then we're really missing an opportunity to provide important preventive engagement for teens in the mental health delivery system.
So you've pinpointed a really important element that, at least in my travels, I haven't heard people focus on so mm-hmm. much. You know, for a while, I heard people talk about the pandemic as the sort of the cause of this spike in mm-hmm. Teen anxiety and stress. And then that sort of has been debunked, because when you look at the data, the increase instances of teen mental health starts well before the pandemic.
Well before.
So some people point to the advent of social media, or let's say not the advent of it, but the proliferation of it, and the wild, wild west landscape that we're living in, where our young people have no guardrails and we don't really know always how to guide them. But you're pointing to something that goes back, I think, even before that.
Yes. Yes.
You mentioned Columbine. That's
1997, mm-hmm. maybe?
So close to 30 years ago.
Yeah,
30. So it's a mm-hmm. whole generation that has grown up in a society and in a school system, as you're pointing out, that doesn't necessarily know how to protect them, and where they have to arrive at school and be trained, this may not be safe. And
absolutely. The research has been always, at least prior to now, has been segmented. So there was mm-hmm. lots of discussion and research. In fact, I did my master's thesis on the effect of divorce on children. Mm-hmm. This is now 30 years ago, but recognizing the impact of specific events that affect kids' development, that affect mm-hmm. how they manage stress and relationships. So it was always segmented. And of course, then there was the ACEs work, adverse childhood events, mm-hmm. that we now know sort of also impacts development. These things were always there, mm-hmm. just in segmented sort of discussions. My belief is that, and having been an educator at the time of Columbine, teachers knew for years that all of these things, socioeconomic status and family composition and family relationships and, you know, stress on parents. We knew for years all of that was impacting school performance and impacting students' ability to be in school in a way they need to be. It was only until these things started happening, Columbine and then social media and then a pandemic. And I just think it's just peeling back the layers. I think it's just making it more clear, but it's always been there.
Yeah.
And I think we've just not done a great job. I remember back in my days working for a community mental health agency, it was always a struggle to get dollars for prevention. One of my first experiences as a graduate student was they said, here's $5,000 of the county's $1 million budget. Here's $5,000 to go and do talking it out peer groups with kids in Housing Opportunities Commission subsidized communities. And it was $5,000. That's all we had. The emphasis was never on prevention. So this idea of like, how do you talk to teens? How do we help outreach to families before there's a crisis necessarily?
Yes.
It was a struggle back then. It's still a struggle today. Mm-hmm. I just think, again, today we have more people aware this is important. Mm-hmm. And I think also, too, parents are also becoming more increasingly aware of their own anxiety, their own stress, their own sort of, oh, my gosh, I can't handle all the stuff going on.
Yeah.
And so we finally have people that are interested and willing to have that work. Right. I remember, again, back in those days, we'd say, here's a prevention. Come learn how to talk in your family. And parents would respond, you know, well, that's fine. We're doing great. There's no need to talk. We're good, right? I mean, and actually, it was in the faith-based community where a lot of that work was happening. Mm-hmm. You'd have church retreats, or you'd have events at the synagogue, or and they'd be like, let's be a better family. And family strengthening was really much more related to the faith community than it was to mental health.
Interesting. So the stigma, you're saying, was lower in those settings.
I think it was lower in those settings, and it was sort of when it was tied to faith and your practice, like be a good parent and let's be a good kid.
We don't have to have a diagnosis.
Right. Exactly.
This kind of support and to learn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we, in those days, actually, we began a community-based work. We did the Talking Out peer group and quickly realized we need to work with the family. Mm-hmm. It's great that the kids come, but the family is where the action is. Mm-hmm. And so we quickly developed a program called the Family Journey. We created a whole curriculum where we saw parents in one group and kids in another, much like the Strengthening Families program of today, and really tried to enforce the idea that the interaction between parents and kids drives mental health and mental well-being as much as individual therapy. It's been challenging to get people to understand that, wait a minute, it's not just my kid has a problem because they're misbehaving.
Yeah.
It's also, hey, what's happening in the family and how can we leverage the very important and connected relationship between parent and child to address those needs, right? And so I think that's what we've seen evolve over time, which has been, I think, a welcome evolution for sure.
So maybe that's a good place to focus in on the specific question of communication strategies with teens. And I love how you just highlighted amazingly important work goes on in a clinical encounter, but the work with the parents, with teachers, with counselors, clergy, all the other adults who interact with a teen in their regular workaday or everyday life. Right. Is so important. We were raised in an environment where, let's say, school was safe. Like it would never occur to us or our parents to be like, okay, you need to know if something happens, here's what to do. We weren't schooled in any of that. And we're now interacting with a generation of, well, the oldest of them are young adults.
Right.
And the youngest of them are, you know, just coming up to their teen years who have been raised in a totally different landscape. How do we as adults who want to be in relationship with our teens, again, whether it's parents or teachers or clinicians, clergy, neighbors, what are some ways that we can think about interacting with teens that are helpful, that are beneficial? And I realize that's a huge generalization to make.
It's a big one. These are not skills specific to therapists. They're not skills specific to teachers or coaches.
Yeah.
Like anybody can do these. And it's important for parents to understand that it's okay to have a little bit of training because, of course, there's this idea, well, this is my kid. Mm-hmm. They've been my kid for whatever, 15 years.
Yeah.
What do you mean I don't know how to talk to them?
Yeah.
You know, kind of.
Yeah.
And then that's never really expressed, but certainly parents come with a sort of preconceived notion that the problem is I'm doing what I'm supposed to as a parent. My kid's not responding.
Yeah. And
helping them shift to recognize, wait a minute, if your objective is to connect with your kid, if what you're doing isn't working, then let's give you something else to do.
You know, to recognize in the life of a family and the life of a young person, they're going through enormous developmental shifts. You know, I don't know when they start, around age 10, around age 12.
Oh, I think it's pretty consistent. You know, Fred Rogers, who was never a trained psychiatrist, psychologist, but he was fantastic in his ability to communicate with kids. And he wasn't particularly well trained in that by any means. But he offered a term back then called the inner drama of childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And he refers to the inner drama of childhood as that which happens to the child that we never know about, right? Their thoughts, their feelings, their inner dialogue, how they feel and think about the world around them, the relationships they're in. And unless we think to ask, we never know.
Yeah.
Right. And so his whole body of work, I think, was always around connecting with and understanding the inner drama, what's happening internally. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's more than how was your day? It's more than what happened at school or when a kid comes in for therapy, what happened in your family? It's really connecting with. So tell me what you're thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
What's your mood and why do you feel that way?
Yeah. So how do you break through? I've been a parent of teens. Yeah. I spent a long time working with mostly bar and bat mitzvah, b'nai mitzvah age. So that's preteen. Yeah. It's just in a first toe in the water of teenagehood parents going through that stage. For many years, and with my own kids and with young people that I worked with in the community, if you brought a question like that, tell me about what's happening. Tell me they'd be like, everything's fine. I'm fine. Yeah. Good. How was your day? Good.
Right.
How do we as adults in the lives of our teens break through some of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the very first thing I tell parents and anybody really who wants to connect with kids is pack your patience and your persistence.
Mm-hmm.
You have to. Mm-hmm. You have to wade through the one word answers.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sit with the uncomfortability of silence.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be okay with it. So I often talk to parents first about how are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's going on for you when you're trying to connect with your teen
mm-hmm.
or your kid? Like, where are you at that moment? I mean, are you doing this perfunctorily? Like, because you're driving in the car, like, all right, what's the day today? What else is going on for you as a parent that you can be aware of to manage and sort of allow to either help or to not hinder the connection with your kid?
I keep thinking of just what happens when you get on the airplane and the steward says, your own oxygen mask on first. So how's your, as an adult, where are you?
Right.
How's your mental health?
Right. And in working with parents in particular, I often ask for probably two or three sessions just with them
mm-hmm.
to say, hey, look, so what goes on with you in your interactions? How are you feeling? What are you hoping for? What's your goal as a parent? Right. Mm-hmm. What are you doing that you think is working? And how do you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do that's not working? And how do you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so really getting an assessment from them first.
Mm-hmm.
That's always important when you're talking about how to help people connect with kids or connect with other persons. What's happening for you? How can you increase your own self-awareness and your own ability to manage and be aware of yourself in the interaction
mm-hmm.
before you try to connect? Because
mm-hmm.
if you can do that, and this is true as a therapist, as a clerical person, as a parent, you have to be aware of that. Because if you're not, and it comes up, boom.
You're not ready for it.
You're not ready. And then what happens, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, oh, you're just irritating, or oh, yeah, I mm-hmm. can't talk to you, or I,
mm-hmm.
and you get immediately you get a communication stopper there.
Mm-hmm. Staying in your scenario of,
sure.
you know, I'm in the car with my teen, and I've done a little bit of mindfulness. Maybe I've even, as I pulled up to pick up my teen from school or from an activity, I've sort of schooled myself, and I've, as you said, I've packed in some extra patience and I would call it kind persistence, because I don't want to harass my child, but I want to signal that I'm here for them and I'm interested in what's happening with them. Then what?
Then what?
Yeah.
You wait, and then you respond,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
In addition to sort of packing your patience and your persistence and your kindness and however you want to frame it,
mm-hmm.
I think the other piece of that is to be aware of that it's okay to have expectations. It's okay to badger your kid Mm-hmm. You're the parent. They're mm-hmm. the kid. You mm-hmm. want to connect. Mm-hmm. It's not bad to let them know, even if it's ineffectual, I want to connect with you.
You matter to
right?
me.
You matter. Mm-hmm. So that's what's important. So continue that, you know, questioning, of course, mm-hmm. right? One thing I learned early on in my work with kids when I was at Camp Green Tree, actually, back in the day, I had to work with kids who needed to be pulled out of program and they were not interested in talking right away. A great strategy was to talk to myself about what was happening, mm-hmm. right? Reveal the inner dialogue. I'm trying to talk to Rachel and it's just not working. And I'm really getting frustrated by that. Mm-hmm. I want her to know that I want to be connected in some way. And it just kills me that I mm-hmm. can't connect.
So it goes back to that thing of first being aware yep. of your own, what's going on internally.
Right. Mm-hmm. And if you say that in front of the kid, mm-hmm. the kid first is going to say, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Right. And that you're in. Mm-hmm. Right? What am I doing? Well, I'm telling you, I'm frustrated. I want to connect with you. And,
yeah.
and so it's about really also measuring the interaction moment by moment. Mm-hmm. Right? Sometimes we'll start a conversation. We have a place we want to get to. Mm-hmm. I want to know, are they going to see that boy again? Because if they are, I'm going to have to tell her she can't do that. Because right, we have a destination in mind. Mm-hmm. Let go of the destination. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. What you need to do is be focused right here in the moment mm-hmm. about what you're getting. Mm-hmm. You think that's weird that I'm talking to myself because I want you to know I want to connect with you. Like you immediately engage with what's happening.
What's happening
right?
in the moment.
Right. Exactly. So yeah. you don't veer off. But well, I got to get it. Are you going to see so and so? Are you going to do such and such? There are tons of strategies. And what I think is always most important for parents to know is that not every strategy is going to work for you and not every strategy is going to feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. Find what works and what's comfortable mm-hmm. and what fits your values. Right.
For sure.
So certainly be aware of all that. And it's okay. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that is really tough for parents in trying to connect is they want to make sure their kid's always okay.
Yes.
Right? The instinct for parents, right, is to, I don't want to make it worse for my kid. Mm-hmm. And I think perfect to the topic and the resiliency roundtable, uncertainty compels resilience. Mm. You have to allow for uncertainty and for uncomfortableness to be present in order for resilience to emerge, right? You can't yes. be resilient if you're not uncomfortable.
Uh-huh.
Then you're just comfortable.
Right.
There's no resilience happening there, right? And so in order for people to be resilient or practice resiliency, they have to feel uncomfortable. And so as a parent, your first instinct is, like you want to wrap your kid in bubble wrap.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. Right.
And so it's helpful to acknowledge that right. and say, but wait, that's not helpful.
Right.
Right? Because right. if I wrap them in bubble wrap, are they going to learn that they can be okay even as they feel angry and irritated, uncomfortable, sad, anxious, right?
Yeah.
Are they going to learn that it's okay to have those feelings?
Yeah.
And I can manage through it, right?
And I'm just thinking about how as parents, again, parents or as teachers, anyone who's in a caring relationship, yep. but let's say parents first and foremost, our anxiety spikes when we feel exactly. uncomfortable. I mean, just your statement just now about the relationship between discomfort and resilience and how they really are in a mutually reinforcing
right.
Relationship with each other.
Right.
In our society, we tend to want to push away discomfort.
That's right.
We don't want to deal with it. And in doing so, we miss out, is what I'm hearing you say, on yes. a really important opening for connection.
Right. That's right. And it can drive the connection to negative places if you can't, mm-hmm. right? And then there's a desire not for no connection. Mm-hmm. I was just meeting with a family this last weekend, and the child is struggling with anxiety, some OCD behavior, impulsiveness. I said, let's have a family meeting. We had the sibling there and the two parents. And as we're talking about these very difficult situations where, you know, the child does something uncomfortable for the parents or for the sibling, and they want to really just tell them, stop doing it and don't do it.
Yeah.
You got to put that aside if your goal is to connect with and understand what's going on. So as we're talking about the problem, what's the kid doing? He's throwing stuff around. He's like fiddling with stuff. Mm-hmm. And immediately, what's the parent's instinct? Stop that.
Yeah.
Focus. Yeah. You're not paying attention. You got to be okay with, no, let's let this, let's just sit with
let
this for
a minute.
Let it play out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And eventually the kid was able to come back and repeat to the parent exactly what we're talking about. And he could say, I'm really uncomfortable talking about this. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm getting blamed. right? Aha! Now we have something to work with. Now we're connecting. You're being seen and heard. And yeah. I can see you and hear it. And I don't want to blame you. And this is about such and such. So that's how you get to the inner drama, the inner voice, mm-hmm. right? You've got to wait for it to come into the space. Parents, we struggle with that, right? Mm-hmm. We struggle with, can we wait? And how long are we supposed to wait? And what if it never comes, yeah, right?
And that gets back to learning to tolerate our own discomfort,
right?
Which we don't want to do.
Right. I always tell parents, let's not worry about what if until it becomes what is.
How do we discern when it's time to solicit some kind of higher level intervention? How do we know when it's time to worry, I guess? Because we're saying so clearly, you know, we're so quick to push away our discomfort.
Right.
We ourselves don't want to feel anxious for our kids, but actually staying in the discomfort is what allows us to see what's going on with them. How do we school ourselves to learn, okay, now I think we need some help?
There's always a time as a parent to worry. I wouldn't categorize it just that way. I would mm-hmm. say when what ifs become what is, that's the time. So mm-hmm. what does that mean? It means rather than you thinking this is happening, mm-hmm. know that it's happening, right? Hear from your kid what's going on mm-hmm. in a way that you can. And again, you've got to stay in that uncomfortable space sometimes. Or if you have concern, what if this is happening? What if you're taking drugs? What if you're having sex? What if you're, what if you're cutting? Mm-hmm. Then it's about, let's have a conversation about it. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of parents struggle. Parents will have minimal conversation and say, oh, we've got to get you to the therapist, right? And we bring them to the therapist or we bring them to the service, right? So it's about having discussion and conversation. And again, it's being in that uncomfortable space. So if you suspect your child's self-harming and you want to have a conversation about it, immediate worry comes, what if I make it worse?
Yes.
They don't know I know. What if they, parents will come in and say, I'd like to meet with you first. They don't know I know this. Mm. I know that they're struggling with self-harm, or I know they're struggling with LGBT, or I know that. And I say, well, why don't they know? Oh, I didn't want to make it worse. What if I talk to them? I say, no. That's not how it works, actually. If you can talk about it, then it makes it better, always. And that's the key thing I think parents have to sort of also ground themselves in, the notion that their kid wants them to be connected. Mm-hmm. We fall into a trap, especially in adolescence, when they're developmentally pushing away and I've got to be my own person, right?
Working on
independence. And, right. And you get very anxious. Do they really want to be connected, right? Mm-hmm. Do they really care? The answer is yes. They do. You've got to find ways in developmentally appropriate terms to evidence that and mm-hmm. talk about that mm-hmm. and recognize for you as a parent, my kid does want to be connected, right? Great. Yeah. And be comfortable in that. Then it enables you then to have the discussions. Hey, it looks like you've got really big feelings. What's going on? Mm-hmm. Or I worry. And it's okay. I think particularly the teen level to say, look, my worry is that your big feelings are turning into something that really is harmful. Mm-hmm. And I'm really worried about that. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that? And I see you, mm-hmm. right? The other piece is, and I often tell parents this too, be comfortable with incremental conversation, right? Mm. It's more than a one-time thing, right? And so that's hard work. It's mm-hmm. really hard work for parents to think like, I got so many things to do. I got to manage my own work. I got to manage three kids. I got to manage the family budget. I got to manage. And now I got to have a series of conversations. Can't we just have one and get it done?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
The answer is no. Mm-hmm. Kids' brains don't work that way, right? The teen brain developmental mm-hmm. challenges, right? The frontal lobe isn't all there yet mm-hmm. and it's not all wired.
Yeah.
We now know that it doesn't happen until 26.
Yeah.
So, you know, good luck, parents. You're in for the long haul.
Yeah.
18 is not the magic number.
I was going to say it must be way beyond.
There could be a range, yes, right? But that's the challenge, is recognizing it's incremental. And I think, too, for professionals as well. I mean, that's why you want someone having conversation with you over and over again.
Yes.
Is let's have that relationship and that mm-hmm. create that ability that we can talk about these things, because mm-hmm. you're going to need to do it repeatedly. No shortage on the internet or books that you can look at. Do this. The real work is focusing on supporting professionals and parents in the how and the why, not the what. The what is easy. You can find that, right?
Okay.
It's about the how and the why.
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to do this? How can I manage myself to be effective in doing this?
Yeah.
And why am I doing this? Can I connect with why this conversation is important to me? Why this relationship is important to me?
Yeah.
And we don't focus enough on the how and the why. I think we focus a lot on the what, because this is what, you know, top 20 tips. Yeah.
Right.
And I don't know that I have that in particular, or I don't think I use that much in my work. It generally becomes organic, right? So this family I was working with, you know, talking with them and here's how, what's important to you, right? Mm-hmm. Well, turns out what's really important to them is they have family dinner every Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so how about you make family dinner every Sunday a way for you to start having conversations that are more meaningful about what are you feeling? Why are you feeling this way? Can we talk about this? So it's more germane to the family culture and to what they experience as a family, how they can comfortably engage some of these strategies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to do as a function of the how and the why, not so much the what.
Okay.
Like, you know the what.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how can you implement that?
Mm-hmm.
And why are you doing it? And can you stay focused on that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that helps people more effectively engage the interventions.
And that, to me, goes back to your opening reminder about patience and persistence.
Yes.
This is a long-term endeavor. It's not a business meeting that we're going to wrap up, and or it's not, you know, our kids are not appliances that we just fix the screwdriver.
That's right. And I'll say there's different developmentally, right? I taught second grade for 10 years, and I had wonderful connection with students. It was so easy because they're, you know, the little ones always, oh, teacher, right?
Yeah.
And then I taught middle school for 5 years. And let me tell you, that was a huge culture shock.
Yes.
Because they weren't coming in. Oh, Mr. Wilson, let's, I had to draw them in with prizes and point sheets and, you know, rewards. And a lot of teachers, a lot of my colleagues of a certain generation will know, I had the Welcome Back Cotter class, right?
Yeah.
So I had all the kids in middle school that were not successful.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal was to get them to be successful. And I will tell you, while people thought it was only my responsibility, it really wasn't. I will say at the end of 5 years, our alternative ed program that we established, which was the first of its kind at the time in Montgomery County, had a 97% success rate. 97% of the kids went on to the next grade level or matriculated to high school.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the way we got there was not just about me as their teacher for four periods. It was the other three teachers that were important. And so my work was also working with those teachers to show, can you connect with this kid? Because if you can connect with this kid, we're going to see progress.
Yes.
Right. And I will tell you, in every circumstance that worked, every time, because they would look and say, well, Mr. Wilson, he's the cool guy because he's got point sheets and prizes. I'm like, no. This is, we got to get, they can do it with me. They got to do it with you. And how can you foster that?
Yeah.
And so it took them to really look at this kid differently, not as a disruptive behavior problem, not as a kid who's withdrawn, not as a, you've got to look at a kid and say, what the heck's going on with them? And why are they experiencing what they're experiencing? And when you can do that and you can find a way to connect persistence and patience, it works.
Well, it sounds like in the educational realm, it's also shifting our goals.
Yes.
I would imagine teachers, you know, they have a very specific set of standards they're trying to reach. They want kids to reach a certain benchmark in terms of content that they're teaching. And you're just reminding us with this incredibly important piece about forming a relationship, nurturing a relationship, and then it's much easier to teach algebra.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's been also, interestingly, studies around what makes successful students, right? And it's not that they get through all of the chapters or all of the units in it, the math and the reading skills and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone down precipitously since the pandemic, not only because they weren't in a classroom, but because they didn't have the connections and the relationships they needed to feel comfortable doing this kind of learning, right?
Yeah.
I was never of the mindset that it's all about the reading, the writing, and the arithmetic. Never.
Yeah.
There were some high achieving parents that wanted to know why their kid wasn't reading on a fifth grade level in second grade. And I said, well, they can read whatever they want, but this is what we're doing. And our emphasis is more about getting them engaged and comfortable with learning and with being part of a community and with how they relate to others. It's about connection. It's about how they feel about themselves engaged in the work that they're doing.
Yes, it's counterintuitive.
It is.
Think, get a tutor, focus more on, and certainly, you know,
that's helpful.
Sweat equity, yeah, for sure.
If a teacher doesn't have a relationship with a student, they're not going to learn.
Yeah.
Period. More developmentally indicated at the elementary level than the middle and high school. Mm-hmm. But it's exactly what I found with the middle school students that I was working with. In every case, they had absolutely horrible connections or disconnections from teachers. Mm-hmm. They felt inadequate. They felt ill-equipped. They felt that they couldn't measure up in any way. And why bother trying? Mm. The number one refrain from kids who are not academically successful is why bother?
Yeah, because I'm not getting anywhere.
And telling them, well, you're going to need this trigonometry when you become an engineer.
Yeah.
That's not going to work, right? Right. You need a relationship. You need a connection.
Well, I think that speaks to the extent to which teens, especially, they live in their moment.
Right.
And they're not super able to
go,
when I'm, you know,
exactly 40, right. It's not developmentally appropriate. That's right. Not. It's really not. But that's what we do. Right. Yeah. We say, no, you need geometry to graduate. You need this to graduate.
Yeah.
And that can carry you only so far. Mm-hmm. Right. Because at some point the teen gets to say, and they're in the mindset of like, yeah, I don't want to graduate. I don't care. Mm-hmm. Right. And then where are you?
Yeah.
You've got to have the relationship. And it's hard work. And it's the work that I think teachers often get frustrated by because the system doesn't allow for that today. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think the system allows for there to be that connection. Establishing a connection was seen as sort of secondary. Like, mm-hmm. that's not the job here. The job is move them through the curriculum. Soft skills. And it was seen as, what an exceptional teacher. You know, I was always talking to my colleagues and saying, we should all have connections with our kids.
Yeah.
Like, why should I be called out or you be called out mm-hmm. because you're such a great, you connect with, we should all be connecting with the kids.
Of course.
Of course. But that's not what the system allows for.
Well, I wanted to say out loud how much appreciation I have for teachers, yes, especially absolutely. Now, and how hard they work, and how much we need their involvement and expertise in our kids' lives.
For sure.
So I'm just trying to, want to end with a question. Like, if there was one takeaway, you mentioned patience and persistence, and I'm thinking again of the scenario that we've been kind of painting of a parent in a car with a teen. Is there something else that you would want to say to parents or sure. to, people who work with teens?
I often use, when I talk about relationships and connection, I use a metaphor with kids and with parents. And I say, imagine if you've ever, been to a dock or a harbor and you see these big ships, right? Mm. And you see this ship that's moored to the dock and the rope they use, right? Mm-hmm. It's a giant rope. It looks like it's made up of smaller ropes, right?
Yes.
And it's all kind of twined together. That's right. Mm-hmm. And, I say, the reason there's like slack there is because the tide rises and falls. There's mm-hmm. always tension, mm-hmm. right? And so what I say is, in relationships, the job is to basically create that connection, that rope, mm-hmm. right? So one person's the ship, the other person's the dock, right? Okay. And your goal is to create that rope. And what I say is every time you can engage in an interaction where there's an exchange of what I think, what I feel, what I need, what I want. That's another connection. That's another thread in that rope.
I think,
what I feel, what I need, what I want, right? Whenever you're connecting with someone and you're having that dialogue, right? You're threading that rope, right? Mm-hmm. There's connection there. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And the bigger it is, the more tension it can hold. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be comfortable that, okay, I've had these conversations with my kid. It's okay that they're not talking right now. Yeah. Right. But I'm going to keep saying, I see you. I hear you. I'm going to keep saying, hey, I want to know, what do you think? What do you feel? What do you need? What do you want? And if you're not telling me, I want to know why. Why mm-hmm. aren't you telling me? Mm-hmm. But that rope then holds the tension. The relationship holds. Right. And it might fray. It might, but it's so thick because you've been doing that interacting all the time.
So when the storm comes,
you're okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. And parents can reassured, like, it's okay, right? And so
that's right. The boat might be bobbing.
That's right. Exactly. But it's still connected.
Yeah.
And I say, that's the goal, right? That's the goal. And yeah, you might feel sometimes, in my work with kids in the neighborhood, they didn't show up one day for a group. I'd be like, oh my God, I've lost them. They're not here anymore. What did I do wrong? And all that stuff happens, but you got to manage that yourself. Thankfully, I had supervisors. I had people that I could go to and say, oh my gosh, I didn't see John today. It's over. It's over. Give it time. And of course, next week, John's there. Oh, sorry, I missed last week. I had my football practice. Okay. But you get this anxiety because you wonder, is that connection still there? Mm-hmm. But the more you build that relationship, the more you're comfortable.
Yeah.
And it's going to be there. So it's okay if there's some silence or if there's some uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
Right?
That image of, anchoring our kids as they surf the waves of their own developmental seasons and their own anxieties, their own challenges, we can continue to be a safe harbor for them, steady dock.
Way to run with the metaphor.
I love the metaphor. I'm going to use it.
Great.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
Really great to have this time with you. And thank you for being our inaugural.
Thank you. I hope it goes well. Right?
Thank you. Thanks for tuning in to Jessa's Resiliency Radio podcast. I'm your host, Rabbi Rachel Hirsch. Today, our guest was Joe Wilson, Senior Director for Mental Health Services at Jessa. Our podcast editor and producer is Gabe Pinkney. For more information about our Resiliency Radio podcast or to learn about Jessa's programs and services, log on to jessa.org. That's JSSA.org. Thanks and have a great day.